They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:24 Wednesday, August 10th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianco. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And I was up until 2 a.m. last night covering the sale. So if I fall asleep during the show, during one of Bill's Red Sox monologues, or one of John's stump speeches to get on the latest board, it's not because I'm bored of their talking. It's just, you know.
Joe, good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent with Thoroughbred Daily News. And yes, you nailed it. I'm ready to talk Red Sox. Don't fall asleep. Now, here's why. Seth Klarman, are you watching this? I sure hope so, or are viewing it. You guys probably don't know, Seth Klarman owns a little piece of the Red Sox. Red Sox are a clown show, an absolute disgrace, an absolute fiasco. They won't spend any money to get new players. They traded away a beloved catcher for a broken fungo bat. The fans are irate. Seth, you got to do something. You got to tell these owners, shut up, John. You got to tell these owners, shut up figuratively or whatever. You got to tell these owners, start spending some goddamn money. Thank you, Seth.
That rant brought to you by Jonathan Green, NyQuil. John, what Joe, but
brought to you by NyQuil.
By NyQuil, exactly. Thank you. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and don't change your computer settings. Yes, I did shave, and it was primarily because my Q rating was so high in comparison to you guys. I had to dumb it down a little bit. So we're going with this for the time being.
I thought it was because your beard wasn't talking to your hair. It was gray and your hair is black. I thought that was why. It was a little incongruous.
No question about it. I got to get the coloring
just
stick.
For men.
Just like Bill does for his hair. I got to get it for my beard. So anyway, that's it for the show. Thank you for joining us at the Writers Room Insult Comedy Hour.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September yearling sale beginning Monday, September 12th. Catalog is now available at theworldsyearlingsale.com. Okay, so we're going to do a little combo week in review segment here with some of the racing and some of the sales news because there's a lot to talk about on both fronts. We'll start with the Whitney. That was the big race of the weekend, and that was the big showdown that we were expecting between Life is Good and Olympiad. Never really materialized because Olympiad did not show up and was a well-beaten fourth. I was on Better Things last week. I picked against him just because I thought that he was going to get a little tired trying to chase Life is Good early. It's just so it's dangerous for horses, not physically dangerous, but just in terms of winning a race, for horses who are usually kind of used to pressing the pace. And Olympiad has had the same trip every single time this year. They're used to chasing horses from the two path, you know, close second, to try to chase horses that have that runaway speed. And Manda's Life is Good have runaway speed. I saw a great quote from Irad Ortiz that two jumps, he just took off down the backstretch, looked like they were going to try to control the pace early, and then it was just, I'm going, you know, catch me if you can. And they almost did. Happy Saver and Hot Rod Charlie especially, I thought, ran really good races to be second and third. Todd Pletcher, Exacta. But Life is Good in the end was too fast. There was a little controversy about Irad's ride. You know, Life is Good likes to meander as it is, and Irad helped him along by jerking him to the inside into Happy Saver's path. I don't think that was particularly dangerous or anything. I think he was clear. But listen, Life is Good is one of the fastest horses we've seen in years, but does he want to go mile and a quarter? That's the main question, and it just seems like a mile and eighth is the absolute max that he wants to go. What do you guys think?
Joe, I guess I'm a little bit in the minority here because, you know, what I'm reading on social media, what people react to otherwise, I was not super impressed by his race. And now, and this is unfair, but I think I've been spoiled by Jackie's Warrior and Flightline and some of these just absolutely brilliant performances we've seen this year, even Epicenter in the Jim Dandy. Yeah, he won. He looked good, but he didn't take your breath away. He didn't blow you away. And also keep in mind, if, you know, with Olympiad just not showing up, you know, what was the competition behind him? You know, American Revolution was scratched. Happy Saver just keeps running second all the time. Midnight Hot Rod Charlie's a good horse, but, you know, not up to that. So, you know, he won. It was never really in doubt, but he didn't wow me in this. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think one of the reasons why is going the mile and eighth is his absolute limit. And, you know, if the race were 7 furlongs or a mile, I think he would have looked a lot differently. And I wrote in Week in Review, I mean, obviously they're going to go to the Breeders' Cup Classic. I understand that. But right now, at a mile and a quarter, and the key being that distance, a mile and a quarter against the likes of Flightline and some others are going to show up, I think he'll have a hard chance, a tough chance of winning that race. I really do. And, you know, that's not taking anything away from him. He's a tremendous horse. He's going to be a very valuable and likely successful sire. You know, he's checked a lot of boxes. He won the Whitney. I mean, the Whitney's a great race. But, you know, I think going forward, you know, they say they might run him in the Woodward at Aqueduct. That's a mile and eighth. That's fine. We'll see what happens. But, you know, I don't know. I was a little bit underwhelmed.
I think I agree with you guys as far as, you know, the underwhelmment part and a little disappointed, especially when you look at the time. When you look at the winning time of, you know, of almost 149, the track record is 146 and change. You know, so they really weren't, from a stopwatch standpoint, they weren't impressive. From an eyeball test, I thought Life is Good was really impressive for the first 8 furlongs. And then, you know, he kind of wrapped up, you know, I wrapped up on him a little bit, did his little, you know, Jimmy shimmy down the stretch, and that didn't look good. But, you know, I don't know if it was that the horse was getting tired, or the horse, you know, was just getting disinterested, or if Hot Rod Charlie and Happy Saver, especially, who came up on the rail, were really, you know, eating up ground and catching up to Life is Good, or if everyone just thought, you know, Irad and the horse Life is Good just thought, this race is won, I'm just going to wrap it up and be done. But, you know, the 107 buyer actually is a bounce. And Joe, I'm going to be interested to hear what you have to say about this from a handicapping standpoint. But you look at a horse like Life is Good, and yeah, 9 furlongs is probably at a grade one level, 9 furlongs is probably the furthest that he can go. And he showed that when he ran a disinterested fourth in the Dubai World Cup, going a mile and a quarter. Just, it's not his cup of tea. It's just not that good. But a 107 after posting, 107 buyer after posting 112, 110, 109 respectively for his previous 3 races, it technically is a bounce if you think about it. And that's what it looked like on the eye test. It definitely looked like a bounce. I also want to just, you know, focus a little bit on Happy Saver. This poor son of a gun has run second now to Life is Good, Flightline, Olympiad, and Maxfield in his past 4 races. I mean, other than Nick's Go, I think we'd be hard pressed to find a handicap horse that's better than those 4 that Happy Saver just keeps being the bridesmaid to. I mean, this is a horse that tries every time and just isn't at that grade one winning level. But man, he just keeps getting put up against all these great horses and generational horses, you know, at least with Flightline and Life is Good. And you can maybe make a case for Olympiad because he had won 5 races in a row coming into, 5 graded stake races in a row coming into into the Whitney. So it was a small field. It wasn't a great eye popping, you know, watch race. But I still think that we're going to see Life is Good, Happy Saver, Hot Rod Charlie, and Olympiad, the first 4 horses, and even American Revolution, the horse gets scratched. We're going to see all those horses competing in the classic. So I think we're going to look back at this Whitney and say, yeah, maybe it was a one off, but it was still a grade one championship race for Life is Good. And Bill, like you said before, he is a generational talent. I mean, he is just that good. And last year we were all excited about Maxfield and Nick's Go going head to head. This race coming up, the classic, is setting up where there's 4 or 5 betting horses in the race that you think on their best day could you know, be standing in the winner's circle. And Joe, I'd be interested to hear about what you think about the bounce theory for Life is Good.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bill's being a little harsh. I think the track had a lot to do with it because it got that midday rain. And I think the track slowed down and became a lot more tiring after they sealed it. I think you saw that a little bit in the test where Chi-Town Lady came from absolutely nowhere to run down Matarea and Hot Peppers. I think on a faster track, I think Life is Good would have had a little bit more chance to have that brilliant blowout win that I think some people might have been expecting from him. But like John says, this was a legitimate grade one field. And I think, you know, one of the keys for Life is Good is just how well he breaks. I mean, you could not break better than he broke in that race. And if horses, I think, if horses were like football players and you get them to watch tape, I think like traders would tell their horses, you know, watch how Life is Good breaks, because it's absolutely incredible. And it's such an advantage because he has to expend so little energy to get to where he wants to be in a race, you know, and it's just every single time he's just rocket out of the gate, rocket out of the gate. And it really puts the pressure on other horses in the race, especially other speed horses, to be sent and to you know, have to break well to keep up with him early. And I thought it was a great training job by Ty Pletcher too, because if you looked at his work tab on paper, it didn't look that special, like 4 furlongs and 48 and 3 and like 5 furlongs and 101. He wasn't, you know, blazing up the track like you see Bob Baffert horses do. But if you watch those works on XBTV, those were like mile works. You know, the gallop out was the part of the work. It was, you know, the actual timed version was really just a warm up, because he was galloping out like strong miles in those workouts. But you know, you have to have a horse, I think, who's willing to train like that, and who's a forward trainer and really wants to get cut loose even in the mornings. And I think he's a remarkable horse, honestly. I do not want him in the Classic. You know, I think he ran pretty much the same race that he'll always run at a mile and an eighth. So I don't think it was necessarily a bounce. I just think that's the cap as far as how far he wants to go. And that just reminds me of they have the Breeders' Cup Classic future pool for the first time this year. Flightline is 2-1. 2-1 on Flightline. What are we, still 3 months from the race? Which is just staggering to me. I'm curious, like, what Bill has to say about that, because like, you know, at best, at worst, he's going to be like 6-5 or 7-5 in the Classic, you know, if people show up. American Revolution, I was disappointed, scratched. He was my pick on Better Things. He's 32-1 in the Breeders' Cup Classic. You know, you talk about the difference in value. You know, American Revolution is a way better value than Flightline. And we still got questions about Flightline, too. He's never been beyond a mile. My Life Is Good has done it a mile and an eighth now twice. Flightline has still never been beyond a mile. We expect him to cruise in the Pacific Classic, but we don't know that until he actually does it. And just one last thing I want to say on the Whitney before I wrap my thoughts is, I got to give a hat tip to Hot Rod Charlie. He's just one of those horses who doesn't have a lot of wins on his resume due to bad luck and circumstances, but he shows up and tries every single time. You know, he's probably going to be a bit of a forgotten horse of this generation because he doesn't have all those wins, but I think he deserves a lot of credit and a lot of love for the heart that he has. You think about the Belmont when he ran that tremendous second to Essential Quality. He ran a good fourth in the Classic last year, chasing Nick's Go when nobody else wanted to. This was a tremendous effort to be third because he had to chase Life Is Good and then make another bid at him on the far turn. I just wanted to give a little bit of love to Hot Rod Charlie, who I think is a super underrated horse.
And Joe, he's been doing this since the future wager. Oh, sorry, Bill. I was just going to say he's been doing
it. That's okay. I mean, the future, same with the Derby. It's a bad bet. I don't know why anybody bets it. You know, 2-1 is a ridiculous price on Flightline, and I'm a huge Flightline fan. You know, first of all, you know, if the race were run tomorrow, I think you're right. It'd probably only be about 6-5. So it's not like you're getting 2-1 on a 1-5 shot. And also, any horse is, what is the percentages they get sidelined between now and the Breeders' Cup time? And that's no reflection on Flightline or I'm saying he's unsound or anything like that. It's just, that's the nature of the game. Keep him healthy for another 2 months is very difficult. But I want to throw the conversation back to John, because I think you're the one of the three of us that I don't think really touched on, you know, the germane topic here. Can you see this horse winning the Breeders' Cup Classic at that level of competition at a mile and a quarter? I can't.
Yeah, Bill, I would agree with you. I would think that that's going to be just outside the scope of his abilities at the grade one level. If he was running at a mile and a quarter, you know, against grade three horses, absolutely.
Sure.
But not with this crop of older horses. I mean, this is really a unique year, I think. If all of them stay healthy, like we said before, there's going to be half a dozen horses that you can really make a legitimate case for. And there's going to be a horse that's going to jump up between now and the Breeders' Cup that's going to make us kind of pause and say, where was this horse before? You know, and kind of toiling in maybe some of these grade three races and looking to step up, you know, almost like Rich Strike did in the in the Kentucky Derby, where you go, this horse doesn't really belong. And all of a sudden, after they win, you go, maybe I should have looked a little closer at some of the prep races. But as far as cementing Life Is Good as a future stallion, there's no question that once he won the Breeders' Cup Mile and some of the race, you know, results that he's put in, some of the performances he's put in, cements him as a legitimate sire. You know, and he's not going to stand for as much as Justify, who won the Triple Crown. But I would venture to guess that even if he doesn't win the Breeders' Cup Classic, being a son of Into Mischief out of the strong family that he has, strong female family, he's going to be a $75,000 to $100,000 stallion, and he'll get booked up. You know, 300 mares will apply for him. Especially when you look at how well some of these young sires like Justify and Gunrunner, how their progeny have done at the sales. I mean, it's at $100,000. I hate to say it because it's a shit ton amount of money, but it's almost a bargain.
Yeah, Judd is already selling those stallion shares. The life is good. Attaboy. he's obviously going to be a very attractive prospect. And just to wrap that up, I do think it's an interesting classic this year because I do think there are legitimate questions about him, and maybe Flightline will just win the Pacific Classic by 15 lengths with 130 buyer, and will, you know, it'll be a foregone conclusion that he wins the Breeders' Cup if he gets there. But, you know, until it happens, I think that it's a really interesting classic field looking at it now. And I think that there will be some chances in that race, whereas last year I thought it was a little bit of a ho-hum field. Even though the horses were pretty nice, I thought betting-wise it just wasn't really that interesting. But I just wanted to shift gears a little bit to the fireworks last night up in Saratoga, because, you know, especially with John here, I'm interested to get his thoughts. There were 10 seven-figure yearlings last night at the Facix Saratoga sale, and the sale, you know, smash records all over the place. And especially, we're going to talk about this a little later. We got a new sponsor and Three Chimneys about the continued explosion of success of Gunrunner. He had the topper in the entire sale for $2.3 million. Sold to the friends at Coolmore, as well as Peter Brandt. But you know, I hear a lot from people about, like, oh, well, there's a recession coming and we need a soft landing and all this and all that. Maybe that's right, but it seems to me like the 0.01% of the world are doing pretty well to be spending record-breaking numbers at these horse sales. And, you know, this week's sale, it just, like I said, it shattered all the records. And I think it bodes well, of course, for Keeneland September, which is coming up now in just over a month. Keeneland September catalog came out yesterday, 4,147 yearlings cataloged. But John, I mean, what do you make of this? I felt like earlier in the year, there was a lot of talk about, you know, a little bit of wariness in the market and whether or not there was going to be a recession coming. There was no sign of that this week in Saratoga.
Yeah. And Joe and Bill, one of the things I can tell you as somebody that follows finances and the horse industry, the thoroughbred industry, especially the sales industry, sales part of it, has always been a laggard indicator. So in other words, if we're in a recession, if our recession technically started this quarter, the effects of it wouldn't be felt in the horse industry for 6 to 9 months later. So that's why even if we're technically in a recession right now as an economy or as a country, you're not going to see that play out until probably next summer's yearling sales. So it doesn't surprise me. Some of the things that did surprise me were, you know, 14 horses that sold for over $1 million. That just shows you that the cream of the crop people are still chasing those horses. And of the 14 million dollar yearlings, 13 different groups bought a horse. So it's, you know, Joe, if you want to say, well, maybe the recession's hitting a little bit in that sense. Yeah, it used to be where you had three or four of these guys getting together or buying individually on their own, these million-dollar horses. But now it's almost like two people are gunning for one horse and one gets it. And then that person who didn't win goes to the next one for two. You know, there's two people that kind of run it up, you know, to a value that they see. You don't see the multiple purchases like you used to. You are seeing more and more partnership purchases. Our friends at West Point bought a couple of parts of a couple of horses that, you know, for over $1 million. Same thing with Magner. And when you look at smart people in the industry like West Point and like Coolmore, you have to kind of sit and take notice that they are still buying expensive yearlings, expensive colts for the most part. But West Point bought in partnership a Curlin filly for $2 million. So, you know, for the most part, it was the boys, but there were some fillies that sold for a lot of money. And again, you look at probably the most important indicator to me was that there was an 80% clearance rate. So that means 80% of the horses that went through the ring sold, which is just a phenomenal number, because that means that not only were the prices exceeding expectations, but that they were exceeding, you know, everyone's thoughts going into the sale as far as how much they'd be willing to keep their horse for. So when you have an 80% clearance rate at an overall sale, that's just a phenomenal number. So, you know, it looks like our industry at least at the top market, is very, very strong. That'll carry over, in my estimation, to book one and book two of Keeneland, which are coming up. And then we'll see. Then we'll see the recession kind of start to seep in to some of the lower priced horses. And you may see a lot of horses in book five or six that don't sell or sell for very little because there just isn't that kind of follow up market. But the top of the market is exceedingly strong.
You know, it was a wild sale because, you know, a lot of time, you know, we cover it at the TDN extensively, obviously. Usually, like, we get down to like the $750,000, $700,000 horses. There were just so many million-dollar horses that you could sell a horse for $800,000 last night and wouldn't even crack the paper because there were just so many seven-figure yearlings selling. And I wonder if that, you know, maybe makes it not great value, John, because I don't know if you guys shopped this sale at all, but it seems like the demand was just absolutely through the roof. And it's just so hard to believe, you know, just from a layman's perspective, watching racing, how many million-dollar yearlings do you see become, you know, multiple grade one winners and stallion prospects? It just doesn't happen all that often. So I wonder what your thoughts are if the demand blows everything out of the water so much that there becomes no value at these sales sometimes. What do you think, John?
We didn't even go to the Saratoga sale because we anticipated that the prices were going to be, you know, so far above normal. Now, we did not expect it to be this strong, but that's one of the reasons why I'm in New Jersey versus in Saratoga this week. We did sell a filly, a Distorted Humor filly, the tail end of last night, again, for almost twice as much as what we anticipated before when she left Kentucky. So we were really pleased with that. I think people are also emboldened a little bit about, with the success of Gamine and Flightline and Corniche, these seven-figure horses that are, you know, are super expensive horses that are having success on the racetrack. It used to be where, other than a handful of times, these seven-figure horses never really, you know, got to that level. They were worth the most when they went through the sales ring that day. But now you're starting to see some of these really expensive horses perform on the racetrack. And when they perform on the racetrack, they exponentially are worth so much more in the breeding shed down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I think Flightline in particular is an example of that, because I still think overall 80-90% horses above $700,000 don't become superstars and you don't make money on them. But yeah, I think having those high profile horses in the last couple of years who did, you know, do well and become valuable and maybe even more valuable than their purchase price, definitely in the case of Flightline, I think does, you're right, embolden people. But yeah, it was crazy two nights in Saratoga. And like you said, that momentum is sure to carry over into Keeneland September in about a month's time. The TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Keeneland. Whitney winner Life is Good as a graduate of book one at the Keeneland September sale. Son of Into Mischief was purchased for $525,000 by China Horse Club and Maverick Racing in 2019. Grade two Glens Falls winner. Forgot to mention her, but how about Warlike Goddess coming back and defending her title in the Glens Falls? Might go after the boys next. And the Sword Dancer, Bill Mott mentioned. She also went through the ring at the Keeneland September sale. Your next opportunity awaits at this year's Keeneland September sale, which starts Monday, September 12th. Catalog is now live and features 4,147 yearlings. Book one includes yearlings out of 89 graded stakes winners and 36 grade one winners, plus siblings to 50 grade one winners. So you can't beat that kind of quality, and we're all looking forward to that sale in just over a month from now. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
When the thoroughbred world descends upon Lexington this November, there is one place you need to be. The place where history comes alive with every championship victory.
He's authentic indeed!
The place where the future is built with the fall of a gavel. The place that exists to be the heart of this industry. The center of it all. Home to the November Breeding Stock Sale and 2022 Breeders' Cup, Keeneland.
Spitestown. Munnings. Echo Town.
It's Echo Town for Joe Talamo and Echo Town raced away.
And Echo Town is drawing away in the stretch. Echo Town wins the Allen Turkin Stakes.
A sire line so prolific, it repeats itself. Echo Town.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Ashford, Sir Uncle Mo had the day one session topper at this week's Racing Washington Saratoga sale. The Colt out of Secret Sai brought $1.5 million selling to the friends at West Point. Woodford Racing and partners Studmate Justify had a yearling Colt bring $1.1 million. Mendelson had his first TDN Rising Star on Sunday with Pink Hue. Looked very, very good for Chad Brown. Mendelson now has 7 winners, with 5 of those coming in the past 2 weeks, including 2 at Saratoga. So he's really starting to catch fire with his first crop. Congratulations as well to everybody at Coolmore for Golden Pal's latest win at the Spa and the Grade 3 Troy Stakes. Future Coolmore stallion and son of current Ashford resident Uncle Mo was winning his 7th career race and 2nd of the year after his Shakertown win in April. Cut it a little bit close in that race. Sure had a lot of people sweating, especially with the horse being 1-5. But it was great to see Golden Pal back on these shores. Hope he stays in America the rest of this year and see him hopefully repeat that his feat in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. It would be his 3rd Breeders' Cup run in a row, which I don't know if any horses have accomplished that. It's off the top of my head. But yeah, great to see Golden Pal back on the track as well. And Coolmore, of course, very busy last night in Saratoga as well. All right, so we're gonna stand up for our fellow media members here. This is a big story this week. I'm going to leave it mostly to Bill here. John said he wasn't going to say anything, but he always says that, and then he comes in and talks for like 5 minutes. So I'll hold my breath on that one. But it was a big story in the past week that the California Horse Racing Board now is trying to institute a rule that media members have to be licensed to go onto the back stretches of California tracks. You have to pay a $75 fee. You got to get fingerprinted. You got to get a background check done, which is obviously ridiculous and you know, spells bad things for racing and the way racing media is allowed to cover the sport. I saw some people suggesting that this was a HISA thing, which, I mean, obviously I haven't read the HISA regulations top to bottom, but why would CHRB not mention that in their press release? And B, why wouldn't other tracks also be announcing similar policies if this was a HISA thing? Obviously, this is ridiculous. And the most worrying part, I think, that some people have brought up is that this could lead to the CHRB and California tracks being more easily able to revoke credentials. And at a time when the sport, if anything, needs more scrutiny, and that's part of the reason we do this show, is that the sport needs scrutiny like it's never had before because of, you know, all the messiness going on in the last decade, especially. It's the exact opposite way that people who run racetracks and run racing jurisdictions should be acting. And it's never good when media is, the people try to restrict media in any sport. And, you know, this has failed. This kind of policy has failed in other major sports. And I think it's doomed to fail in racing because of the big uproar that has come out of this. And it just, I would love to hear the California Horse Racing Board really explain themselves as to why this was necessary. Bill?
Yeah, I mean, this is some serious Big Brother stuff here. And, you know, so many points we made. The first one is, why? Who saw the need for this? You know, did something happen that we don't know about? You know, why did the California Horse Racing Board, after all this time and all these years, where since the beginning of time, credentials are handled by the racetracks, decide to come in and say, no, you've got to get a license from us? And, you know, this creates so many problems. And first of all, you know, this just flies in the face of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. And, you know, again, why was this necessary? The fee for the license is only $75, but it doesn't matter if it's $75 or $750 or $1. You can't have the media having to pay money for essentially the right to do their job. And Joe, you really hit the nail on the head. But the biggest issue here is that, you know, now that if a media person is going to be licensed, they're under the control of CHRB, just like if John Green gets an owner's license out in California. So clearly they have the right to fine somebody, to suspend somebody. And, you know, suppose somebody writes a story that the CHRB is a bunch of buffoons and they did this all wrong. Are they going to suspend their license? I mean, you hope that they won't, but just the fact that they have that power or could have that power to do something like that. Yeah, I mean, you know, we talk about un-American. That just flies in the face of everything that, you know, we know and love about our country and how, you know, the First Amendment and the rights of the media and the press. Here's another problem, too. Next year, the Breeders' Cup is at Santa Anita. You've got to have hundreds of journalists coming in from all over the world. You can ask some guy coming in from Japan to cover the Breeders' Cup. Oh, excuse me, Mr. So-and-so, before you can have cover the Breeders' Cup, you've got to come in at Santa Anita a week early and get fingerprinted to cover the race. I mean, it's just so outlandish and so unnecessary. You know, the CHRB, hopefully they're listening to the blowback. Hopefully they'll understand that this was just not a good idea and they'll, you know, say, never mind. But on the surface right now, things it's really, and one more point, horse racing is dying for more media coverage, particularly from the mainstream media. I mean, the day and age where the mainstream media pays attention to the sport are over, but maybe they would come out to the Breeders' Cup. So why are you going to do something to discourage mainstream media and the media as a whole from covering your event? I mean, nobody's saying to, you know, the New York Times, they've got to pay $100 to send their writers to the Super Bowl. That's exactly what it would be like. It's just unfathomable. It's nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think it's, I don't know what the motivation specifically was for this, but I think it's emblematic of kind of this this anti-press sentiment that's bubbled up in the past 5 years or so, particularly because of Trump. There's a documentary recently that Ronan Farrow produced that's on HBO. I think it's called Endangered. And it's really worth watching, and it's interesting. And it follows four journalists, you know, around the world whose ability to practice their craft and to cover things and scrutinize things is being threatened, and sometimes physically with violence. Obviously, racing media, we don't face even close to that level of pushback, but the concept is the same, that I think a lot of people feel comfortable and emboldened these days to have this, you know, very blanket, like, anti-media, anti-press sentiments, the media is the enemy of the people and all that stuff. And I don't know that in a past time where that didn't really exist, at least on the surface, that CHRB would have been comfortable coming out with a policy like that. And I think, you know, kudos to the racing journalists who have made such a big stink about this. You know, I think of Jay Privman and Teresa Gennaro and Jeremy Ballin. Like, I think, you know, we do have a lot of good reporters in this sport who are, you know, rightly, you know, drawing a line in the sand and saying, no way, this is not going to stand. And yeah, you know, I think Bill makes the correct points that this is a fundamental thing. This is a fundamental right of the press thing, a freedom of the press thing, where once the entity starts controlling who can come cover the sport, you know, and essentially who can say what if they're in charge of revoking licenses, then you no longer have freedom of the press. And Bill makes another great point that we should be begging people. We should be begging people to come to the track and cover the sport and give us a little bit of shine, especially now in California. You know, I think about this too, because California and the CHRB definitely deserve some credit for this. All the good stories that have come out of California in the last couple of years, with the vastly improved safety record and drug record, and there is a lot of good news to report on. And now is when you decide you're going to kick the media members out, or at least make them pay for the privilege of covering the sport. It's ass backwards in every single way. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in the CHRB's deliberations on whether or not they were going to do this and the statement they were going to put out, because it seems like there should have been one person with some common sense in the room that said, you know, guys, this might not look great. This might, you know, even if you felt like, you know, this was a necessary step, you would think about the optics and be like, you know, is it really a good idea to be restricting media access on the backstretch at our tracks, especially when the sport is, you know, withering a little bit as it is. And it's, you know, especially when there have been so many stories worth covering in the last couple of years, it's mind boggling. And I hope that they backtrack on this. And I think people need to keep the pressure on them for sure. And I don't know whether that's, you know, boycotting covering the Pacific Classic or Santa Anita or any of these things, but it just, someone needs to take a real about face on this and apologize, frankly, I think, to racing and racing media, because this is authoritarian stuff. And like Bill says, it doesn't matter. It's not about the price of the license. Like, the license could be $1. It's the fact that now the CHRB is going to control who can cover their sport, and then consequentially, who can say what about their sport. And that should be unacceptable to everybody in America.
So I agree with everything you guys are saying. Can I just be devil's advocate and ask you guys a question as media? When was the last, honestly, when was the last time either of you were on the backstretch of a racetrack?
Yeah, but John,
no, I mean,
I'm sorry, we're not good, talking but about Joe Bianca and Bill Finley. We're talking more about the people like Jay Privman, the boots on the ground at these racetracks. So it doesn't matter if this affects 200 riders or three riders. It's the principle behind this. It doesn't affect me. There's no chance in between now and maybe next year's Breeders' Cup, and I even doubt that I'm showing up on the backstretch of a California track. But there are people that want to do that. And in particular, let's take the San Diego paper there that maybe would come out opening day and Pacific Classic day or something like that. You know, maybe now they just say, no, we're not going to do it. And, you know, how does that affect and impact the sport that is looking for all that kind of exposure? So, I mean, I don't think this is a Bill Finley and Joe Bianca issue by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a larger issue for, you know, while we may not be there, there are dozens of other people that need access to the backstretch at these racetracks. And, you know, they still get it, but now they get it with a caveat or with a restriction placed, you know, on what they can and cannot do. And look, you know, the first, maybe the CHRB is more reasonable than we're giving them credit for, but, you know, let's take, you know, writer X, and he shows up and, you know, like I said, writes something derogatory about the CHRB. How are they going to respond to that? You know?
And it's trending. It's one of the top 10 stories on Twitter right now, which is really surprising. Because obviously a lot of the media is picking it up. And guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this like the second slap in the face of a racetrack or a racing jurisdiction against riders? I remember when Arlington Park was closing, didn't they just kick everybody out of the press booth? Like, they're like, get out of here now. Like it wasn't even.
I mean, I feel like that was more of a petty thing because, you know, everybody was waxing poetic about the track closing. I thought that was like, you know, I don't think that was like a, that wasn't like a policy. I think that was just one guy being a dick. And to your question, John, no, like I'm not on the back stretch all that often. The next time I'll be on the back stretch is to feed Writers Room a peppermint this weekend at Saratoga. So no, it doesn't affect me all that much, but it leads to the point. I think the logical conclusion of this is if fewer and fewer people start covering California racing because of this, then California racing can control the narrative and just put out press releases, and there'll be really no reporting other than what the CHRB decides is, you know, consumable for the public. And that's a terrible spot for anybody to be in. Like that's what I always think about when people are like, oh, fake news and media is the enemy and blah, blah, blah. It's okay. It's like, okay, so let's follow that. Do you want to get to the point where the leaders will just tell you what to think and tell you, you know, what they want you to consume and believe? Like, you don't want any kind of reporting whatsoever to get to the truth. You're just okay with the president saying, here's how it is, here's what's happening, no questions, please. You're okay with that if you're one of these media is the enemy of the people? Yeah, like, it's just, it blows my mind. Like, just because people are upset that, like, the media is like, will report negative stories on a politician. They like, they don't want any journalism anymore whatsoever. Just daddy, tell me what to believe and I'll believe it. So like I said, I think that's kind of undergirding this, is that anti-media sentiment that's going through the world and especially America right now. But I think, like I said, it's been good that there has been such fierce pushback about this in the racing media, with a lot of good journalists speaking up about it. And I think CHRB will have to reverse course eventually. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. After late nominations for the first leg of the two-year-old PA-sired, PA-bred Series 44, nominations are in for the Whistle Pig Stakes and 53 for the Miss Blue Tie-Dye. The second leg of the series, which consists of two $200,000 stakes, will be run on Pennsylvania Derby Day at Parks, which is September 24th. Nominations close on September 6th. Pennsylvania Day at the Races is now less than 2 weeks away on August 22nd at Parks. There'll be over $1 million in purses with seven $100,000 stakes. If you own a PA bred or PA sired horse, you'd be silly not to show up on those 2 days. Definitely a good program that the PHBA runs, and we look forward to those races at Parks. We'll be right back after this message from the PHBA.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at Parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd, PA Day at the Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series, yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled to welcome on this week. We're thrilled to learn something this week on the Writers' Room. Professor Ernie Bailey from the UK Gluck Center's Research Center, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. And so you guys have been in the news a little bit recently because at the end of June, you released the first part of the results of the geneticism study and the study of thoroughbred genetics. And it's a big, obviously, hot topic in racing because there was the proposed 140 mare cap for stallions. And the concern behind that was supposedly that we're weakening the breed and it's becoming less diverse, the thoroughbred genes over time. You guys found that, at least through part one, that that's not the case. Can you talk about the research that you undertook and the conclusions that you came to?
Sure. The premise for the study was the back talk about diversity. Thoroughbreds have been selected for 300 years. There's been a small population that started from. And so people are justifiably concerned that maybe diversity is being bred out. The tools that we've had to look at that have been incomplete. We've used blood groups, we've used biochemical markers, microsatellite DNA, and lately SNP markers. And all of those markers sample a small part of the genome. The best one that we've got is picking up 0.02% of the genome. And we now have a really great tool. We can do whole genome sequencing. We can sequence every single base, every single piece of DNA in a horse. And so that's the complete assessment of diversity that one can do. And so we thought that with all these questions that were circulating around, why don't we use this particular tool? The costs of doing sequencing have been dropping precipitously over the last 10 years. It's just come to the point where it is feasible for us in research to do that. So I got three colleagues, two other colleagues, Ted Kalbfleisch here at the University of Kentucky and Jessica Peterson at University of Nebraska. And the three of us set out to sequence 100 thoroughbred horses to assess the diversity that exists. And the way that we did that was we went out and solicited samples from over 1,000 thoroughbred horses. And the breeders were very responsive, very helpful for that. From that, we looked at the pedigrees, so we picked the 100 horses amongst the 1,000 that appeared to be the most diverse. And our goal was really to capture all of the common genetic variants that exist in the thoroughbred and a lot of the variants that are fairly rare, less than 0.5%. So that was our goal, was to basically get a snapshot today of what the thoroughbred looks like. The results that we had were interesting. We're not the first to have done this. There are two other studies that have done it before. This is the largest study that's done it. And all of us have found that there's considerable genetic diversity in the thoroughbred. The other laboratories have sequenced horses of a variety of different breeds, warm bloods, quarter horses, Andalusians. And when you look at the diversity that exists in these different breeds, we find that the diversity in the thoroughbred overlaps that. This means that the thoroughbred breeders have done a good job over 300 years of continuing to maintain the diversity in the breed. That's not to say that there isn't a decrease when breeders are selecting for horses. Inbreeding is a constant part of it. And so inbreeding is going to gradually increase over time. And so what we want to do is to be in a position to monitor the changes in the genetic diversity.
Ernie, thanks for that explanation. And you know the debate on one side led by the Jockey Club are saying that there is a problem here and we need to limit the size of the books that a stallion is bred to 140. The other side led by some of the big stud farms say that's not right. There's no problem here and you can't limit our business. So far as answering that question, whether limiting the book to 140 is a good idea, really not necessary, or maybe, something else, how would you answer that question after the study?
There isn't any academic information that says 140 is a magic number as to protecting the integrity of the breed. I'm not sure where the number came from. And it's one of the things that we would like to do is to be able to look at the diversity, model the breeding, and make a recommendation as to what is the proper approach. I'm somewhat personally skeptical that 140 is an issue. There is, as this study has shown, a lot of genetic diversity that exists in the thoroughbred. It's common sense that if you reduce the number of stallions that you use, that you would restrict diversity, you would restrict inbreeding. But the study that we did shows that there's a lot of genetic diversity. And so this is a really small effect. There's perhaps 100,000 mares that exist, brood mares that are out there, and they basically contain most of the diversity that exists in the thoroughbred. And so it's likely that the restricting the book size for a small number of stallions is going to have a very minimal effect. It would be a bit like trying to turn a tanker around, an oil tanker around in the middle of the ocean. If you have a rowboat that is pushing on the bow, you're not going to have a very large effect on it. I don't know what the answer is. I'm skeptical about 140, but I think that when we have the numbers about the diversity, we can then model and make a prediction of here is the best way to manage it. And it may not be restricting the book, and it may not be a matter of making changes now. The real question that exists is there's a lot of diversity today. We are continuing to inbreed the horse. That is part of improvement. You're trying to get rid of the bad genes and you're trying to concentrate the good genes. This is a good thing. Inbreeding, can be beneficial. But at some point, we don't want the horse to become a clone. And when will this happen? Is it going to be in 20 years or in 60 years or in 100 years? And we can use modeling to do that and give advice to breeders based on these real numbers.
That's a great answer, Dr. Bailey. And as somebody who's been very outspoken against the 140 mare cap, I'm glad that there's some genuine science behind that stance. One of the things that I think the reason why they came up with the 140 mare number had to do with a study of standardbreds that was done, by the standardbred industry. And again, I think our understanding is that thoroughbreds have a lot more genetic diversity than the standardbreds do. But I think that's where they came up with the original 140 number. When you look at the way that people are breeding mares to certain stallions, a lot of breeders are doing it based on what the hypothetical mating grade is. Okay, I'm sure you're familiar with those, with those ratings and NICs and those programs. Could you tell our audience a little bit about if it makes sense or if it's not enough, information to make a huge investment based on a work NIC or on a true NIC grade?
You're getting outside of our area of expertise. I mean, we, academics, we require having huge amounts of information in order to make decisions. And I'm somewhat, I admire breeders because they have much more limited information and they're making these choices and making the plans. They have very special skills that are quite different from what we're doing. For me to do the same thing, I would have to have 100 times more information than the breeders are doing. So I admire what they do. I have no comment about it. It falls outside of my expertise.
Dr. Bailey, I asked this, I mentioned this in my first question, that this was part one of the UK Gallic Center study, and part two is coming up. Can you talk about how part two will differ from part one, how it'll pick up on the same research, and kind of what you're trying to find out in part two?
Well, what we had reported earlier was simply the numbers, because we had just gotten the sequences. It was quite exciting to see the extent of diversity. It matched that in previous studies. And so that was the information. It was simply the raw number of genetic variants that we found. What we're hoping to do is to publish a complete paper this fall, and it will include looking at some of the structural variants, because in the genome, there are inversions, there's copy number variants, there's a number of different types of variation that exist. We want to look at, there are measures of inbreeding that are called regions of homozygosity. And while breeders look at the pedigrees and they can calculate inbreeding from that, we can look at the DNA and ask how many regions of the DNA are actually showing this type of homozygosity. So it's a lot of it is pretty wonky, but we're hoping that it will provide a nice picture of the thoroughbred genome today, the status of diversity. And we can use that, say, 5 years, 10 years from now to assess, you know, what changes have come about. I mean, one of the problems that exists right now is we don't have a standard from 10 years ago or 20 years or 30 years ago. This technology is quite new. And so we could go back and look at 40 years ago blood groups, but we don't do blood groups anymore, and they are fairly limited. So this, I think, is going to be the standard going forward.
Ernie, thank you for not being too wonky. I think you've done a real good job of explaining this to the layman. But let's go right back to the very basics of this. We keep throwing this word around diversity, and you know, we talk about it being important, but why is diversity in a breed so important?
Well, I mean, diversity is the raw material that the breeders are using for getting the performance. There's probably different ways to have a successful racehorse. I mean, there are tall horses and short horses and distance horses and sprinters. And so the breeder is taking has a palette. I mean, there isn't a perfect genome that exists, but there's a palette of colors that the breeder is using in order to try to create or choose a valuable racehorse. And the diversity is responsible for that. And I don't want to overemphasize that, because what we know about genetics is that the genetics plays a significant role, but after that, the management and the trainer are hugely important. But the starting point really is this palette of colors that you use, and that is the diversity that exists. The other issue is that diversity is also important for health. And we know from looking at some small wild populations where the numbers of individuals get down, they lose genetic diversity, they lose the ability, their immune systems become more restricted. They're less able to respond to infectious diseases, to pathogens, because of that loss of diversity. So we want to maintain diversity in order to maintain the health as well. And I think there's a third aspect, which is, suppose a novel pathogen comes in. We just experienced it with COVID-19. COVID-19 wasn't as, didn't wipe out the population, fortunately, but say something comes in that had a serious high level of mortality in the population. It's the genetic diversity, we hope, that will protect the population from being wiped out. And that's not something I think that we want to see with the thoroughbred, but that is another aspect, is to have the diversity. Say a pathogen comes through a barn, some of the horses will become ill, some of the horses will resist it. The horses that resist it are barriers to transferring the disease further on. So it's important at the population level for diversity to exist.
Okay. Dr. Bailey, if you will, I have two questions for you. The first one is, you know, you walk around the sales and people talk about, well, I'll only buy a daughter of Bernardini, or only buy a gray tappet. And you know, they feel like that there's a genetic reason why, even though it's probably anecdotal. Can you tell the audience if there's really racing potential that can be linked to sex or color?
I'm not a breeder, but I mean, at this point, we have looked and tried to find evidence for that, and we've not. I mean, in terms of sex, there is a sexual dimorphism in horses, as in most mammals, where males tend to be larger and more muscular, and so they may perform well. And so we see this in horse racing, because there are races that are restricted to females and races that are predominantly males. Color, nobody's found any association of color. And the thing is, what we know now about genetics is that there will be a single base change that will alter the binding of a receptor that leads to the production of melanin. It's hard to imagine how that has anything to do with racing prowess.
Great. No, I appreciate that. And my final question to you is, you know, with all the genetic studies that you're doing, and I know that genetics is an ongoing, fluid kind of science. Are we in our lifetime going to get to the point where we can see cloning in thoroughbreds? Like, if somebody has a hair of Secretariat, that they'll be able to, you know, basically regenerate, for lack of a better term, another Secretariat?
You know, the thing that made Secretariat a great racehorse was a variety of things. And one of them certainly was his genetics, you know, that were unique. Another was management. Another was the training. At a meeting once, there was a farm manager who came up to me. It was just after someone had come through and just said, genetics is only 30% of the performance of a racehorse. Management is 60%. So don't worry about the genetics. And so I was kind of discouraged. I'm a geneticist. You know, I wanted to champion genetics. And this guy came up to me and I was walking out. My head was kind of down because the speaker had kind of dissed my discipline. The breeder came up and he just said, you know, tell me about this genetics. I'm really fascinated with it. I said, why do you want to know? Why do you want to know? Because the guy just said there it wasn't important. He says, no, I'm the manager. I do everything perfect. The management, the training, all of that I control, and it is perfect. The only thing out of my control is the genetics. So I've got to know more about the genetics. So you come back to what are the things that are out there? So you've got genetics, you've got the management, you've got the training, but there's one other thing. You know, even if you cloned Secretariat and had all the same training procedures, we don't know in development what events happened, you know. For a particular muscle cell, how many times did it divide? How far did a neuron migrate and so on? These are things that are random, truly random events. And the thing that happened with Secretariat was that he was the best example of his genetics. He was the best example of his training. So if you had a race and you had 10 Secretariats that were running, the original would be the one that would win. I have no doubt about that because he was truly unique. And many of the things were outside of our understanding.
John's trying to create the new Jurassic Park of old retired Hall of Fame thoroughbreds, it sounds like. Yeah. So last question for me, and this is more of a conceptual question, because there's been a lot of talk recently about how infrequently horses run these days. And I think a lot of it is training methods, but there is a school of thought in racing that it's because we're selecting horses who have not run as often to become stallions. They're not as sturdy. They don't have the longevity that previous stallions had. And it goes for mares as well, but not as much as stallions. Not asking you to comment on whether that's happening and that's weakening the breed, but conceptually, is that a possibility? Is that something that could happen over time where you pick horses that don't run as frequently and you breed them and then the progeny don't run as frequently and that could just kind of snowballs? Is that possible?
I just come from a Havemeyer Horse Genome Workshop, and a number of people are actively investigating it. I mean, that is a real question, but we don't know the answer to that. But that is a reasonable thing, and there are studies underway, and I encourage people that if they are invited to participate in them to do so. The scientists, when they do these studies, the information is kept confidential. That is really a standard in science, and there have been regrettable instances where the names of horses have been published in studies, and we have punished our colleagues that have done that. But we have a standard really of keeping the information anonymous when it comes out. But that is something that we would like to handle. You know, one of the things, the thoroughbred is really an amazing athlete. He is an amazing athlete. And that is one of the things that brings people to the racetrack to see them. I mean, we like to see Olympians. We like to see football players, like to see basketball players and great racehorses because they are just exceptional individuals. And I think that when you disparage the breed and you disparage the genetics of the breed, you're going to discourage racing enthusiasts from participating. And so I think we need to find out. I think we need to ask real questions, and I think we need to have real data to back up, you know, the claims as to what's going on. So I'd like to know, you know, are horses becoming genetically unsound? What can we do about it?
All right, Dr. Bailey, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate the work you guys are doing. It's so important, especially in this hot debate about, you know, stallions, you know, mare caps and geneticism. You guys are doing great work. Thanks so much for the time and explaining it to us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great to talk to you. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Dr. Ernie Bailey will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV workout of the week, which you can see on the screen right now, is Mo Strike, who worked 4 furlongs and 49.65 at Saratoga on Sunday. Brad Cox trained Sanford winner is now pointing towards the September 5th hopeful stakes. Got to think he's one of the main contenders for that. And in the XBTV workouts, always a great resource for the Saratoga and Del Mar meets. So Flight Line getting back on the work tab and really stepping it up for the Pacific Classic coming up. Got all those two-year-old works, all those stakes works. Go check out XBTV if you're watching Saratoga or Del Mar at all this summer. Helps out from a handicapping perspective. Really helps you get the jump on some of those babies we're going to get to see in the second half of the meet. Everybody ready for the weekend preview segment, which is now sponsored? We are now sponsored by Three Chimneys for the weekend preview segment. So hit hat tip to Three Chimneys. A lot of exciting things going on over there that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. But we have, you know, we have some action at Saratoga that we're going to get to. We're going to have some action at Del Mar that we might get to. But the big action this weekend in the middle of August is at Churchill Downs. I almost forgot about this until I saw the PPs and the entries come out. Saturday they're going to run the Arlington Million and the Beverly D at Churchill Downs. Obviously, those were heretofore run at Arlington Park, and we all miss Arlington already. And I don't want to give Churchill too much credit because they are taking the wrecking ball to Arlington Park, but it's at least nice that they're keeping up the tradition of these races and picking out a day on the calendar to run them. Those are going to be the two grade ones. Saturday at Churchill is an 11 race card. The Arlington Million, not all that interesting. I think the interesting part is Smooth Like Straight, who's going to have to stretch out a little bit to a mile and an eighth. It's not a mile and a quarter anymore because Churchill can't run mile and a quarter turf races. Santin, who won the Turf Classic earlier this year at Churchill, is back in this race. It's a little bit interesting. Beverly D is a short field, 5-horse field. But the subplot of all of this, unfortunately, I think, is the Churchill turf course. Because they haven't run any turf races at Churchill since June. They were supposed to run races, it was like early in June too. They were supposed to run races on the July 4th weekend on the turf. They had to cancel those. They had to cancel turf racing for several weeks at Churchill because there were problems with this new turf course. It's a brand new turf course that was built over the off season that they debuted this year at the Churchill spring meet. So fingers crossed, you know, for safe racing and all that. And I've seen this scenario or thought of this scenario where there hadn't been turf racing for months, and you come back for one day and run two grade ones on it. It's a little bit scary, but hopefully they've gotten the issues, you know, worked out, and, you know, turf racing can be back full time in the fall at Churchill. But any thoughts from you guys on the Arlington Million or the Bev D?
Yeah, a couple of things. And Joe, I agree with you. I mean, Churchill is the outfit that everybody loves to hate. They didn't have to do this. And I do think they deserve some credit. And, you know, I'm trying to think why, you know, it seems everything they do is just bottom line oriented. I don't know how they're going to make any extra money off this or anything like this. They're paying out the big purses. But on the other side of the coin, these fields for the Arlington Million and Beverly D are not particularly strong. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Only 5 in the Beverly D. In the Arlington Million, you got a few more, but between the two races, only one foreign runner, Aiden O'Brien, brings in a horse for the Beverly D, and not a single foreign horse in the Arlington Million. So I'm wondering if some trainers were a little bit hesitant that, you know, okay, we're uncertain about the turf course at Churchill, let's pick another spot. I also think the mile and eighth might have hurt them a little bit too, because at the mile and a quarter versus a mile and eighth are two very different races. And the mile and eighth is now going up against the 4-star Dave at a mile on the turf at Saratoga. So I think that that's part of the equation in here. But, you know, hopefully, and, you know, I don't think there's any reason to believe that it won't be a safe day of racing. The turf course won't hold up. But it's also, I don't think you mentioned, Joe, the fact that there were two other turf stakes on the card, the Secretariat and another one, I don't remember the name of the other one, that they actually canceled. So they're not going to take a chance to run more than the two. Not great fields, not races that you're getting too excited for. But yes, it's good to see the Arlington Million and the Beverly D still out there, and that tradition is being upheld.
I think that when these races run, there's going to be a lot of people holding their breath for that minute and 50 seconds each that these races are, because they're going to be holding their breath, hoping that every single horse that runs, finishes safely, more so than they're hoping for an exciting finish. You're right, Bill. They don't have to do this. And it's really weird the way that they set it up to have basically this short meet. And I know people usually love these boutique days and boutique weekends and everything like that, but I just don't know how it's going to be received. I'm glad that Churchill Downs is honoring the fact that they're running these two grade one races, because grade one races are still grade ones and they're really difficult to get back once you lose that status. But when I went through the PPs, yeah, I was disappointed also. It's just not a great field. And then I went back to look, historically at the last couple of Arlington Millions. And guys, this is my humble opinion, but this race hasn't been that great for a while. Bricks and Mortar won it in 19, but I'd be hard pressed for either of you to name a winner in the past five, Arlington Millions, unless you bet on them. It's not that great of a field. You don't look back on this race in particular when come Breeders' Cup time and say, who won the Arlington Million? Because that's a key race. So this race has really lost its luster, as far as entries for a long time. And I'm just wondering if Churchill is holding on to it with the hopes that they're going to be able to reconfigure it and repackage it and make it a different kind of race and a more spectacular race, either, earlier in the year, maybe when they have their usual meet, or something, because it's just these two races in particular have lost their luster and their excitement, at least from a betting and from an owner's standpoint.
Yeah. Well, and also I'm interested to see what kind of handle they get on the card, because like I said, I'm sure I'm not the only person who forgot that these races were being run at Churchill in the middle of the summer, and they're going up against Saratoga. Arlington usually had pretty good handle on that card, but Arlington was a track that got a lot of great on track handle as well, which I don't think Churchill is necessarily going to have this Saturday. You guys are right, and then Bill makes a good point that at a mile and an eighth, it's competing a lot more with the 4-star Dave than it would have been, if it were still at a mile and a quarter. Maybe in the fall, maybe if they want to go up against the Joe Hirsch or something, because also now, Kentucky Downs is not that far away. We're only about 3 weeks away from Kentucky Downs. So I think that those races have become more marquee races on the calendar that, people might be overlooking. Even though these are grade ones, it might be overlooking these spots for the big purses at Kentucky Downs. And yeah, it's like you guys are saying, on the one hand, it's nice to see the tradition of these races kept up. But on the other hand, middle of August, mile and an eighth, Arlington Million with Smooth Like Straight's going to be the favorite. Don't know that that's going to get it done going forward, and it's going to be worth keeping these races, at least on this part of the calendar. So we're going to take a quick break and toss the Three Chimneys ad, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit of the Saratoga races, because we got the 4-star Dave and the Saratoga special Saturday, and I'll be there. It should be a great day of racing. Three Chimneys in a very interesting and great spot right now. They have the number one right now first crop and second crop sires, which is not often, especially for Three Chimneys. Obviously, it's not a small operation, but compared to some of the other gigantic international operations, they're not quite at that size. So for them to have the top two sires in the last two crops, at least right now, is pretty amazing. We're going to talk about Shah Rasteca after the break, because he's been a revelation. But Gunrunner, obviously, has been the revelation of the past year plus. We saw it last night, the $2.3 million Gunrunner called. Everybody is jumping in to get a piece of Gunrunner. It was reported last week that Cyberknife's stallion rights have been sold to Spendthrift. So the stallion farms are already trying to get in on the ground floor of those Gunrunner grade one winners. Who's going to stand the first grade one winner by Gunrunner? And John, you're a breeding and sales guy. I'm hesitant to think of a horse that's gotten off to this kind of start in recent years. Obviously American Pharoah and Justify have had great starts for Coolmore. I think of Nyquist a little bit, although he's kind of, I'm not going to say fizzled out, but he's come down a little bit from that big high. Who's the last horse you saw, John, that came out this strong in their first two crops?
Boy, that'd be really hard to come up with one. I mean, you can say maybe American Pharoah, but American Pharoah is because he came out so strong with his first crop, and his second crop just wasn't up to that level. who was still a very good, you know, a very good group. He's the first one that kind of comes to mind when you talk about the first two crops hitting the ground running like the way Gunrunner is. But, you know, just the fact that, and Joe, you weren't here on that one show when we were talking about the Haskell, but the fact that it was a Gunrunner exacta and three of the top four horses that finished were Gunrunners. You know, Gnight, who won the Grade Two Amsterdam, you know, within the same week, it was amazing that Gunrunner had so many horses that were not only running in the big races, but hitting the board in the big races and winning the big races. So it's been a little bit of a surprise, I think, for most people in the industry. I mean, look, the horse stood for $75,000 his first crop for a reason, because he was a great runner, son of Candy Ride, and had confirmation out the wazoo. I mean, he's very well conformed. So it wasn't that he was a superstar surprise that his horses are running this well. But I think, you know, to a person in the breeding industry, if you said to them, is Gunrunner going to have the success, the initial success that he's been having, I don't think people would have expected that his foals would have been this precocious, number one, and that they would continue to run in all these grade one races and grade two races and just be astonishing. And that's why he had two yearlings that sold for seven figures, because his foals are proven to be runners, albeit, you know, I probably had the only Gunrunner that I can't run. But that's, you know, that's no big deal. But the main thing is, don't focus on me, please. The main thing is that Gunrunners are running all over the place. And we couldn't even get a Gunrunner season for our mare population last year. That's how strong of a first crop group he had.
Yeah. I mean, and just you're looking at the numbers. I'm looking at the TD and sire list now, the second crop runners. He's got nine black type winners. The next closest one, I believe, has five. Which is a Classic Empire. Shout out to Coolmore for Classic Empire. But he's got nine black type winners, 20 black type horses, five graded stakes winners, 14 graded stakes horses, three grade one winners, and four grade one stakes horses, which is just, it's mind-boggling that he's that far ahead of his intake right now. So we'll be right back, and we're going to talk a little bit about Sharp Has Tech after this message from Three Chimneys.
Here comes Tama. Tama in the center of the track with good looking stride, squares off with Cyberknife. Cyberknife takes the lead. Tama going with him. These two in a thriller. Cyberknife just in front. And Cyberknife has won the TVG.com Haskell over Tama. Jack Christopher finished third. The running time, 1:46.24 seconds.
Gunrunners on top of the world.
Come dream with us at Three Chimneys.
And it's all Tyler's Tribe to the final furlong. He's putting on another show tonight. He is eight lengths in front. Now it's 10, now it's 12. Tyler's Tribe pouring it on as they come down to the line. He's going to win by double digits, and he stops the clock in 1:04.
I mentioned before the break that Three Chimneys has the top first crop and second crop sires right now, which is a remarkable accomplishment. It's obviously early in the first crop season, but you know, Sharp Has Tech is kind of lapping the field the way that Gunrunner is lapping the field with his first and second crop runners. Sharp Has Tech has 16 winners so far in his freshman season. There's a lot of stallions that don't even have 16 starters yet on the track. He's seven ahead of the next horse on the list, which is Bolt Doro with nine. So he has been a revelation, especially for a horse who only stands for $5,000 right now. I'm sure that fee is going to go up just based on what he's done so far. And especially as we get later in the year and these horses start running in grade one races, they're just going to make him even more and more valuable. And I like Sharp Has Tech for one particular reason, Son of Freud. I love having that New York breeding influence continue because Freud has been a terrific New York sire and sire of New York bred. So he's, like I said, he's been a revelation at only $5,000 at Three Chimneys. So get in while you can now with Sharp Has Tech, because if his horses keep running like this, that fee is going to double, triple, quadruple, quintuple. You know the deal. It's definitely the time to get in. So we got a couple other races to mention. Not a gigantic weekend of racing at Saratoga, but we do have two graded stakes. We got the grade one four-star Dave and the grade two Saratoga special. Looks like a nice weekend of racing overall. Four-star Dave looks like it's going to get a pretty short field. You got Smokin' in there, it looks like. Casa Creed. Looks like Regal Glory might try the boys in the four-star Dave. We don't have the entries just yet, but trying to follow in the footsteps of Got Stormy. last year. And, you know, she's obviously has put her name in the record books with her 4-star Dave heroics. So it looks like we're going to have about 6-horse field over under whether Chad is going to have more than 3 of the 6 horses in there. And then in the Saratoga special, we're probably going to have a short field also, but that's because of the presence of Gulfport, who, and there's been a lot of nice 2-year-olds who have run so far this year, but I have yet to see a race that measures up to Gulfport's win. And as John would say, the Bashful Manor Stakes, where he ran off and won by a dozen lengths in a total canter. And he's just a super, super powerful looking horse, son of Uncle Mo, I believe, from the Friends at Coolmore. And I'm really looking forward to seeing him. I don't think it's going to be a great betting race because he's going to be 1-5 or 2-5 or thereabouts. But I'm really looking forward to seeing him on the track. Anything else from you guys on the Saratoga races?
Yeah, first of all, believe it or not, Chad Brown has never won the 4-star Dave. Can you imagine a Grade 1 turf stakes race in New York? He's never won it, but he's going after it with Regal Glory, the filly taking on the boys in there. And Mr. Cassie sure proved that that's done, can be done. Got Stormy won this race twice in recent years for that. And I want to, on Gulfport, let's look, he won by 12 and a quarter lengths and must be a superstar because in that race was no other than Stay on Good Side. John?
That's exactly right. We can honestly say that we were one of the horses that got trounced by that superstar.
It was an honor. It was an honor to be trounced.
It was an honor and privilege. All I can tell you is that Gulfport has the best hind end quarters that I've ever seen because I've seen a lot of it. That being said, guys, you guys touched on all the important parts of the races, but you know, you mentioned Chad Brown and you know, this is a stake race, the 4-star Dave that he hasn't won. How about it looks like he's only going to have one horse in that race, and there's 2 grade ones at Churchill that we just talked about, and he's only got 1 entry in that in one of those 2 races too. Where the hell are all Chad's, you know, good turf horses? Why aren't they running in the Beverly D? And why doesn't he have more than 1 horse in the Arlington Million? And how come he's only going to have 1 horse in the 4-star Day? For the love of God, man, where are his turf horses?
I mean, he ran 1, 2, 3, 4 at the Diana a couple of weeks ago. I think he might have 2 in the 4-star Dave. I think he's going to have Masson in there too, won the Forbidden Apple, but maybe not. I'm just looking at the probables right now. But John, I think Chad's going to be all right. You know, it's just
No question he's going to be all right. But here's a guy that really controls that sector of racing.
His thing is, I feel like, more turf fillies and mares than the boys.
So he's got nothing in the Beverly D.
Yeah. Right. Which Chad, step it up. Awesome. You heard it from John Green. Chad, step it up. You're slacking. You know, you're falling Rougier off. In the Beverly John D. Green said it.
John, he does have Rougier in the Beverly D, which is his 11th best filly mare.
He's got the one. He's got the one.
Exactly. Exactly.
I know. That is the truth. That is the truth. I was interested to see that in the Beverly D, there was a 3-year-old filly that's coming over that Aiden O'Brien's bringing over, actually.
Lily Pond.
Yeah, which is interesting also. But anyway, we've already talked about those races ad nauseum. Anyway, come on, Chad. Where are those runners? We want to see you in the winner's circle, buddy. That's it. We'd like to see your smiling face in the winner's circle.
Tough crowd. Tough crowd. The guy's got like 30 winners already at the Saratoga meet, but yeah.
I'm not criticizing him. I'm just asking. I don't want to have my California license revoked.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership could vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. You can learn more at westpointtb.com. West Point was busy at the FASIC Saratoga sale. That's an understatement. Coming home with 3 yearlings, including the full sister to their greatest stakes winner, First Captain, for $2 million and the day one session-topping Uncle Mo colt that brought $1.5 million. Huge weekend for West Point 2-year-olds as well. Last weekend, 3 winners and a close second from 4 starters. First winner of the day, Battle of Normandy, was really impressive. She looked really good for Shug McGahee in the opener on Whitney Day. Looked very, very strong. At Ellis, Jace's Rogue got the win and earned a TDN Rising Star honor. He's trained by Brad Cox, owned by West Point in partnership with the Albaugh family. And finally, Perfect Prank by Ashford Sire Practical Joke broke his maiden at Horseshoe, Indianapolis. So the West Point 2-year-olds showing up and showing out all over the country as you would expect. I think that 2-year-old success is only going to ramp up as we get later in the summer and into the fall. So we'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership.
Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse, every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
TDN Riders Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy graduate Sharp as a Tack, who I mentioned, in the Sharp as Tech a bit, should have mentioned him specifically because he looked very, very good weighing the Tyro recently for Doug O'Neill. He owns the highest 2-year-old turf buyer speed figure of 2022, scoring an 85 in that Troy win at Monmouth. He'll be pointing towards the $500,000 juvenile sprint at Kentucky Downs on September 8th, while his yearling half-sister prepares to sell with Legacy at Keeneland in September. Obviously, yearling sale season is in full swing right now, so go hit up Tommy or Wendy. They'll take good care of you.
Joe, can I just add in that they have a really interesting-looking Baltimore colt near in the New York Bred Sale coming up, hit 571, who is a son of a stake-winning Unbridled Song mare and a half to two other stake horses. And again, a New York bred to boot. So Bolt D'Oro, another up and coming young sire and out of a black type female family. So I wish Legacy and their clients the best with that Bolt D'Oro New York bred hit 571.
Hear that, people? John Green is on it. John Green is on that horse, and you know how he likes to take it to the mat. So mm-hmm. Definitely go take a peek at that horse on the sales grounds with Legacy. This week's Remy cartoon. I feel like these are getting better every single week. And I'm not going to take all the credit that he knows he has to step up his game because the cartoons are going to be shown on the preeminent racing podcast in America. But I love this one, especially this week from Remy. It's a rich woman in the back of a limousine with the champagne bubbling and a really nice setup that says, "Driver, take me shopping. The usual Saks, Bergdorf, and Facing Tipton." That's what it was like last night. You know, all of the glitterati were out last night and throwing down crazy sums of money. It was an incredible night, and we're looking forward to that continuing later this year at Keeneland in September. All right, so with that, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Don't forget that Keeneland September sale starts Monday, September 12th. Catalog is now live with 4,147 yearlings. You can check it out at the World's Yearling Sale. .com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Ernie Bailey, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. Maybe see some of you at Saratoga this weekend, and we'll see you next week on the show.